listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we have our weekly conversation with Professor Tony Montero via Skype from Philadelphia with an update on Russiagate, the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, the midterm elections coming up, and a lot more. Okay, Tony, so, wow, let's see. Russiagate, Kavanaugh, S-300s, spies, who knows what else. Let's start, I guess, with Russiagate.
Yeah, because, you know, that is where it begins, and that's where it's still at, and that is what all of this is about. That the deep state and the neoliberals, who call themselves liberals, had expected a Hillary Clinton victory and a hard push on Russia with the Ukraine, Eastern Ukraine, with the Baltic states, and especially Hillary Clinton had said, were she elected, she would establish a no-fly zone over Syria.
Yeah.
With the election of Trump, all of that has fallen apart. Not to mention the other side of this, the withdrawal of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, his renegotiation of NAFTA, and his pullback, at least gesturing towards that, of a pullback from an all-out support for NATO and for the U.S. Military war games and the U.S. Military presence on the ground and around the seas of the Korean Peninsula. So at that level, which I think is the fundamental level, everything orbits. Trump is unacceptable because he has violated and transgressed what is the neoliberal, neocon, unipolar, dollar-denominated world that they were pushing to maintain. So that's what it's all about. And even Kavanaugh cannot be understood, the hearings and so on, cannot be understood outside of this global imperialist framework and, of course, the 2018 elections fit into that.
Wow. You know, I mean, they managed to make, you know, this attack on Russia to continue it, really, through the loss of the 2016 election. You know, when we saw it, it's been, you know, shaping up almost since 1993, really. Clinton, the war on Yugoslavia, the interference in the presidential election in Russia in 1996. Certainly ever since Putin took office, and particularly when they started to push back on the invasion by Georgia of southern Russia and the interference in Ukraine in 2014. There was, you know, war games going on, you know, upping of military resources in Europe and Asia focused at Russia, and increasingly also China with the South China Sea. In other words, all of these things necessary to fully implement this policy were being, you know, put in place bit by bit. And then Trump gets elected, and part of the program is to, you know, back off of some of that. And yet with this Russiagate narrative, you know, we saw even a vote in the Congress of 400 and something to, you know, 5 or 10 to add sanctions to Russia after Trump became president. It's the deep state seems to still be in power with respect to this particular issue.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And this is one of the great contradictions of this moment, and which makes it quite unique. You have a president who, on these matters, literally stands alone. They took down Flynn, General Flynn. They have convicted Manafort, and what convicted him, I think, which swayed the jury, was this whole idea that he was doing business on behalf of Putin in the Ukraine, right, when it was completely the opposite.
Right.
He was working for the then Ukrainian government, but on behalf of moving them closer to Western Europe rather than to Russia.
Right.
Trump pretty much is besieged in the White House. I think at this point he is campaigning to hold on, that the Republicans hold on to the House of Representatives as a hedge against his being impeached. I therefore take umbrage with those people, sadly, who continue to label him a fascist. Does he play to the extent white racist views of a large part of his base? He does. But that is not the totality of the question, because he's also playing into the class interest of a good part of the industrial workforce, as witnessed by the fact that the leaders of the industrial unions, the UAW, United Steel Workers, the United Electrical Workers, and the AFL-CIO as a whole, have met with him on several occasions on matters having to do with NAFTA and other trade agreements. We should also keep in mind that he is talking about renegotiating the trade deals with Europe, with the European Union. So he is a, as we say, a transgressive, almost subversive figure in American presidential politics. There's never been anything quite like him. And there's never been anything quite like the move of the dominant sections of the ruling elite to bring him down.
Yeah, this is certainly a lot of uncharted territory. It's almost impossible to avoid, depending on what keywords you type into Google, for example, things. If you type in removing P-R-E-S, one of the top hits is removing president from office. And you get, like, the top one I found is Reuters. Today, from August of 2017, that details impeachment and the 25th Amendment, how to remove the president from office. So you get, looking at this, a majority of the House of Representatives would allow impeachment, but impeachment, of course, is not removal from office. Impeachment, rather, is removal of the immunity from prosecution, and that in turn enables the removal from office, which requires a two-thirds vote in the U.S. Senate. That's a stretch at the moment, looking at the polls.
I think it is, yeah. but of course it is a political strategy.
Yeah,
I would say it, albeit a desperate one on the part of the Democrats, to make a move for 2020. To literally enable him. They thought this Kavanaugh circus would do it.
Yeah.
But it is. I think it's backfired on them.
Yeah.
Because rather than animating and exciting what they consider to be the natural female base for Democrats, rather than doing that, it's doing the opposite.
Right.
And it's exciting Trump's base.
Right.
So even if they move, you know, on impeachment, as you point out, what that is, as a political maneuver, it still might not work. And here's why I don't think it will work. I think the anti-establishment sentiments among a decisive part of the American electorate is so deep and he is their representative, it's so deep that it's difficult to imagine it disintegrating in the face of an all-out attack by the corporate media upon Trump, directly or indirectly. I mean,
yeah.
And this is a political moment, the likes of which none of us have seen.
Yep.
Ever.
I mean,
maybe ever in the history of the country.
We're seeing evidence of that repeatedly. Every time that there's a massive, you know, one of these massive attacks on Trump, they get surprised that at the end of it, his polling goes up.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
There's another example of that today with this Kavanaugh thing. And particularly, and this is very important going into an off-year election, in terms of hardening the resolve of people to vote to protect and or take out the their respective favored party, you got also the phenomenon as this phenomenon goes on of the loss of legitimacy in the institutions, the anger and willingness to look outside of the almost robotic responses that people were conditioned to politically for decades, looking at, an outsider champion. In the absence of Trump, if they're successful, I mean, that mood is there. So they have to offer someone else. Well, Sanders, also benefited from that back in 2016. I don't think he's going to be that champion again. I think he's exhausted it. They whip out Warren. She's a tamer version. You've got Harris, and I don't credibly see anybody buying into Booker for that, but whatever. Whoever they wheel out, though, to substitute for this, for the same reason that it didn't go away with the taking out of Sanders, the conditions facing people are either going to improve under Trump, which is going to harden his personal support, or continue to deteriorate, which is only going to intensify this feeling of anger and alienation. And so if they put a faker in there, you know, one of their own wholly owned corporate subsidiary fakers in there. You know, 10 minutes later, when they fail to deliver and they start talking about why we need more austerity and war, you're going to see a response again from the population. And it's going to be angrier and more hardened and more skeptical and more willing to get radical than they were by electing Trump.
See, and I think one of the great ironies of this moment is that it is possible, not in the 2018 election, but in 2020, Trump could increase his black support substantially. And there are polls that show that Trump is improved very, very much among black voters, his support among black voters. The other thing in 2018, although the districts that they have to flip are pretty much all white districts or majority white districts, those districts also could be decided by a small black and Latino vote. Right. And I would suggest that black folk, whom I know best, have no incentive to vote in 2018 in any significant numbers. I don't think the anti-Trump position of the Democrats and their hiding behind the Me Too movement is enough to encourage black voters to vote. In other words, black voters will vote by not voting. And I think in 2020, Trump looks very strong generally, but I think from the 5% that he got in 2016, it could go up to 10 or 15% very easily. And I think the key thing will be the industrial Midwest, right, and his renegotiating NAFTA, his talking about bringing the repatriation of capital back to the United States, and his whole thing with China and the so-called trade war is really about General Electric, General Motors, Apple, the big chemical corporations and other U.S. corporations that have gone to China under the rules of the WTO as a way of seeking out the cheapest sources of labor. And what Trump is saying is that at least he hears the voice of the workers, of the farmers, of the others who are not a part of the financial oligarchy. And this resonates. This resonates very deeply.
You know, an interesting piece on the front page of Washington Post today. As Trump's tariffs boost the steel industry, workers wonder where their windfall is. In other words, clearly the Washington Post is an enemy of Trump. Bezos personally, has it in for Trump. He's trying to take him out. He has been from the get-go. I don't think anyone debates that. So what we're seeing, though, is the same Washington Post that said that this program, that treaty, this tax bill is not going to boost the steel industry. In fact, it has. And so now it's a matter of repositioning it and saying, okay, well, who gets to own this? And so they're farming the area of, were enough people hired yet? Or is there enough of an increase in wages, et cetera, having to acknowledge already that, well, he did what he promised and it worked like he said. It's just a matter of, has it reached the people that voted for him yet?
See, and I think going forward, we're going to see something quite interesting, especially as the labor movement moves towards him on trade and away from the Democrats. This will provide for Trump what should have materialized after he won in 2016 and the campaign upon which he ran, right, a left wing that is saying the opposite of what his right-wing supporters are saying. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That directs him more towards the working class, towards the black community towards Latino communities and not be enslaved for political expediency to the likes of Fox News and Hannity and those people. Right now, there's not a significant left that is saying to Trump, we agree with you here, we agree with you on Korea, we agree with you on Russia, we agree with your non-interventionist position. We know that there's a right wing pulling you in the opposite direction, but you should know there is a politically active left wing and labor base that you will need going forward. And I'm certain that he is open to listening to that side. But at this point, that is not the vocal side. If he is to survive in the short run, sadly, he has to succumb to the support that he's getting from the right-wing Republicans. But he transcends. And this is the key thing. His politics transcend the normal politics of the two parties, Democrat or Republican. He just has not yet had the opportunity, I believe, to fully expand the base of his potential support.
You know, it's an interesting dance that we've seen since the late July, early August, when Trumka from the AFL-CIO had that little sit-down, and he was literally praising Trump over his position on trade and the implications of that for workers in the United States. And then by September 2nd, which is the beginning of the election season, basically, he turns around and hits Trump hard over a lack of support for the working class. And so you've got that phenomenon going on, but you also have the stuff that's going on. Normally, the leadership, quote unquote, of labor unions, I think more specifically, completely in the tank for the Democrats. You have some exceptions like Reagan, you know, et cetera. Their dedication to imperialism is even greater than the dedication to the Democratic Party, and I think that was the breaking point with Reagan and to racism too, where it factors. But you've had now a situation where the working class, first of all, the union membership is down to a fraction of what it was 30, 40 years ago. It's been a steady, I would say erosion doesn't, it's an erosion like the kind that you get, and after a hurricane. The erosion has been a steady thing since at least the PATCO strike during Reagan. And so their own personal influence is, as leaders of unions, has weakened substantially, and also the institutional power of unions has weakened substantially. But they, the leaders still have to follow somewhat the sentiment among the workers, and the workers are absolutely among the most disillusioned for some of the reasons I just detailed of right, all people in the United States. And they, a good part of them, at least the ones that we saw in Ohio, for example, and the phenomenon that we saw Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, et cetera, Pennsylvania, they were willing to try Trump out, and he has done the things he promised from the NAFTA and TPP and all of that. And like we just mentioned with steel, there's starting to be a response with all of that. At some point between now and, say, 2020, certainly, if Trump actually delivers economically, does the gravity of that even pull the leadership of the labor unions in the U.S., by compulsion, basically?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they're already there. I don't know what Trump has said. I know that he has met at the White House, along with other leaders of unions, with Trump at least twice over questions of trade, hardly reported. There's no interviewing of labor leaders after the renegotiation of NAFTA. They weren't at all. No one asked what the labor unions thought of this. It is though the corporate media is not only trying, but has succeeded in keeping the voice of labor out of the discussion, even of economic issues that are vital to working people, mm-hmm. which says to me that somebody somewhere understands that there's a political shift, even at the level of the leadership of the industrial unions. I'm focusing upon them because that is what this, all of these trade deals are related to.
Right.
That among industrial unions, I don't know what Trumka said, but I do know he said that the AFL-CIO supported Trump in the renegotiated NAFTA when it was only with Mexico. I know he said that. And I'm certain when it comes to the Canadian deal, he has said nothing less than that. But you're right. At the level of the rank and file of labor, be it miners, be it steel workers, be it electrical workers, be it auto workers, at that level, there is a perceptible shift away from the Democrats towards Trump. And I would say that you cannot pigeonhole Trump as a Republican. Right. He is not a Republican president in the traditional sense of a Nixon or Reagan or a Bush or even the leaders of the Republican Party, like a Romney and on McCain and so on. So I think we're looking at a political transition to, first of all, the collapse of the two-party system. We talked about it a lot a few months ago about the collapsing Republican Party. It seems that in the short run, they have reconvened in an alliance with Trump for the 2018 and maybe the 2020 elections. But if the Democrats don't take back the House, at least the House, I think the processes, I should say, of disintegration of the Democratic Party will then occur. But the significant thing in all of this is the legitimation crisis, where the masses of people will not and cannot accept the governance and rules of governance and the rules of rule of the elite. This is a moment where the masses attack the elites and go in the opposite direction of the elites on all questions. This is the significance of this moment. And of course, this moment begins with the 2016 election and the defeat of Hillary Clinton.
I mean, the situation you describe is half of the pre-revolutionary condition when the
Absolutely.
Elites cannot
Absolutely.
Rule in the manner in which they're accustomed. Well, you know, half that formula is when the people won't allow them to, and they don't
That's
accept
right.
that rule.
That's right.
And that seems certainly to be pretty close to where we are at this point. All right, we've got go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's right.
No, you go ahead. I'm sorry.
Now we've got about 4 minutes left. The last thing I guess I wanted to touch on is depending on the outcomes. I mean, we've got the possibility of either more or less status quo in Congress or some major shift towards the Democrats. Status quo or a shift towards the Republicans would also be status quo in terms of protecting Trump from impeachment and also perhaps in giving him room to pursue his agenda if you have status quo. If there's a radical shift the other way, of course, then he's under stress. So what do you see happening in November, one way or the other? What things will happen regardless of the outcome of the election?
Well, I don't think the Democrats are going to take back the House. And that is very important. That is huge politically. And if they can't take back the House in 2018, their chances of winning the presidency in 2020 almost get to the level of zero. I mean, it's almost their situation is worse than Trump's was in 2016.
Let me point something out in there, too, by the way. If let me point something out in there, too, by the way. If the Democrats take the House back, They get to choose the speaker. If something happens, plane crash, you know, Congress, you know, votes, whatever, and they remove Trump and Pence, Speaker of the House is the next president until 2020. So this is a very, very significant thing, regardless of what else happens.
Well, and what you're describing is something that comes close to a constitutional crisis, a huge, major constitutional crisis. Again, you know, we always refer back to the Civil War and the constitutional crisis that the secession of the South represented. This is a different type of constitutional crisis, but nonetheless a constitutional crisis. And, you know, the again, the removal of Trump would only put the vice president there, which would mean they would have to impeach him as well for a Democrat to become the president. Does that mean that, well, we don't know what it means, and it's all speculative. But I think what we're looking at, and I think the Democrats are beginning to come to grips with this, that the way things are trending, it does not look like they can take the House back. And if they don't take the House back, as a party, I think they're pretty much done. And the other thing is, that means they will go into an internal struggle. And it's not just the so-called left or Bernie forces versus the so-called right or Hillary forces. There are many factions within the Democratic Party, the labor faction, not to mention the black vote within the Democratic Party, which I contend is very independent. They usually vote by not voting, and they know the country, broad sections, especially of the white population, are in rebellion against the elites.
Tony, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The idea of freedom of speech is under threat. Speaking your mind can land you into serious trouble. Now you are presumed guilty and must prove your innocence. The herd rules and the sovereign individual is cowed into silence. Speech has been redefined as virtue signaling. Crosstalking political correctness. I'm joined by my guest, Daniel Bonavec in Austin. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Texas, as well as a contributor at Newsmax. In New York, we have Rob Taub. He is a political pundit and journalist contributing to the Huffington Post. And we have Gavin McGinnis. He is host of Get Off My Lawn on CRTV.com. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Gavin, I'm not on your lawn, so you don't have to ask me to get off it. We're in the wake, almost in the wake of this whole Kavanaugh spectacle, really a disgusting spectacle for the U.S. Senate and for the media, I would say here. But we learned again through this whole saga, you have to be careful what you say. You have to filter yourself about what you say. And I'm referencing here, of course, the Me Too movement. Things have only gotten worse. They're not getting any better. Gavin in New York, go ahead.
Well, it was a trap. It was an allegation that went out there, and they were testing the Republicans to see if any of us would say, she's a liar, I don't believe it, she's a slut, blah, blah, blah. And we didn't take the bait. We carefully said, let's hear her out. We have due process here. We started with the Magna Carta, and we took it very slowly because they were dying for us to slip up and disparage this woman.
Okay, Rob, I mean, has the left acquitted itself very well in all of this? I mean, here's this young woman yelling and screaming at Senator Flake, and then it comes out that she's really a highly paid operative to go into elevators and scream at the top of her lungs with the cameras already there. I mean, I understand it's politics, but at the same time, you know, there's no virtue in that kind of thing here. I mean, there is an advise and consent process here, and that's exactly what the Senate was trying to do. Go ahead, Rob.
Well, that one woman is not representative of the whole Democratic Party or anybody else upset with Brett Kavanaugh. And there are bad actors on both sides, the worst probably being our president, who started out with some decorum last week and said she seems very credible, and then acted himself like a 17-year-old frat boy the other night. He just couldn't keep his mouth shut. And I think he sets the tone for the whole country, and we all begin yelling at each other from both sides. Look, I'm not pleased with Cory Booker either. I think if you cut his head open and saw what was inside, it would just say me in giant letters with exclamation points after it.
And well, certainly won't have Spartacus in there. Daniel, the lonely conservative in Texas, you're up next here. It seems to me that this whole university culture of political correctness has now invaded society in general here. Don't question, nod your head. And Rob is absolutely right. The woman screaming at Senator Flake in the elevator doesn't represent all women. But at the same time, Kavanaugh does not represent all men. Everyone has the right to due process. And I think that's what's missing right here. Go ahead, Daniel. What are your feelings about this?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I've been shocked at the number of people on both sides who are willing to leap to conclusions before they've actually seen any evidence. I was in a position for 10 years when I actually had to investigate certain sexual misconduct claims at the university. And you can't start out with an assumption that one person or the other is telling the truth and the other is lying. You have to see how it goes. You have to wait and take time. I think there was reason to be suspicious here in that Dianne Feinstein held this for weeks until finally coming out after the hearings initially were over. I think that was something that would reasonably make one think something was being hidden. But otherwise, I think you just have to wait for investigations. You have to wait and hear testimony. You have to weigh different accounts at different times to see whether there are discrepancies or whether people are telling exactly the same story. You have to hear from other witnesses. And that process, as bizarre as it has been at certain points, has actually now taken place. So I think it would have been wise on both sides for people to simply wait. I thought the hearings shed a lot more heat than light. And
absolutely,
for the most part, senators disgraced themselves.
Yes, I really damaged the process. Let's think about what kind of precedent has been started here. Gavin, blaming both sides, I don't at all. I think the left has been disgraceful in about this, moving the goalpost every single moment. They lose on one thing, they move it the goalpost again, and they keep doing it. It's, you know, the FBI has concluded its investigation, apparently, but I don't think it's over yet because the goalpost has to be moved again. Go ahead, Gavin, in New York.
Yeah, I'm not buying this sort of there's bad guys on both sides and there's good guys on both. There's bad guys on the left. The left plays dirty pool. They use children all the time. They're the ones doing the hate crime hoaxes. Every time you hear about a fake Me Too thing trivializing real rape, it's a liberal, it's an activist. And they've been doing this forever. Remember that Muhammad clock? Nice clock, Muhammad. Bring it to the White House. No, Ahmed was his name. Sorry, Ahmed. And that was some little kid used as a pawn to sort of pretend that Islamophobia was a major problem at his school. They're always using children and women and hoaxes, always playing dirty pool, and then they just sweep it under the rug and they're on to the next crime. Like, Kavanaugh's already over. They don't care. They're unflappable. They'll be on to some other fake P-tape or some other ridiculous fraud, and they just keep doing it in an effort to prevent Trump from getting reelected. And the irony is, It's this kind of dirty pool that is going to get him reelected.
Yeah. Yep. I tend to agree. The more the media demonize him, it keeps him in the media here. Rob, I said in my introduction that, you know, freedom of speech is being replaced with virtue signaling. I mean, it seems that the left, when it can't win on the merits, it can't win the argument, then it goes asymmetrical. And it's doing it with greater frequency, and the weaponization of the Me Too movement has only made it worse. Okay, you're a good liberal friend of mine, so I'm not saying it's you, but this is a phenomenon that I think is prevalent on the left. Go ahead, Rob.
Oh, it's just a new terrain and a new territory for everybody involved. You know, I wonder what would have happened if 10 years ago or 5 years ago we said we would be investigating charges against somebody when they were 17 years old.
Yep,
I happen to not like Brett Kavanaugh. I don't like his whole tenor and his manner and the way he handled himself in the Senate. And if we wanted to solve this, maybe Donald Trump could have found a better candidate, or the Republicans could have let us have Merrick Garland when we wanted to nominate him in the first place. But be that as it may, we're just seeing a whole new world out there right now, and it is kind of odd. We're allowed to yell hideous, obscene things and say F you to the President of the United States on Twitter, which I see people do daily. As much as I dislike Donald Trump, I will respect the office. Yet then, conversely, in print, as an established journalist, I'm sometimes afraid of what I say and write, because I will be attacked for it.
Yeah, and you're going to be attacked primarily on the left, not the right here. Okay, Daniel, Rob just said something.
Oh, everybody goes after me.
Okay, well, you know, Daniel mentioned Kavanaugh's demeanor, I think. Maybe that wasn't the word, but that was what he was getting at. I guess this is where we are. I watched his statement in front of the Senate committee, and I almost cried. I just thought, my goodness, somebody's not afraid to say what's on their mind, particularly when they're protecting themselves and their family. And the left lambasts him for that, okay? I mean, I guess we really have two Americas right now. I thought it was a stupendous job, something that I will remember for the rest of my life because it made me feel proud. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, I agree. I think he did a wonderful job, and so did Lindsey Graham in defending him. Of course, someone is going to be angry when they've been accused of things that are false. And so if you go in with the assumption that she's telling the truth, you're going to have one attitude about his reaction. But if you think in the end he's innocent of these charges, of course he's going to be outraged. And I, too, was really pleased. I think it's absurd to think that all of the change in the tone of our discourse has been due to Donald Trump. I think he's the reaction to this. The left has been out of control for really almost 20 years now. The attacks on George W. Bush were outrageous, comparing him to Hitler and so forth. I think there was a huge amount of real nastiness there coming from the left exclusively. And it wasn't until Trump's candidacy that someone on the right started punching back. So I think Trump is the response to all of this. He's not the cause.
Okay. Gavin, and flipping through the channel CNN, MSNBC, as this Ford story collapses, they don't seem particularly interested in it. Now they're interested in if Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court nominee, is an alcoholic. In a nanosecond, they switch the narrative. It's remarkable. They don't even reflect upon their own words of the last 2 weeks. Go ahead, Gavin in New York.
They're like a drunk chick, aren't they? You know how a woman will get to a point after maybe 4 or 5 wines where she's just like a stick of dynamite and you're scared of just setting her off, and she starts ranting in different directions and then gets hysterical, then is crying, then is mad, then is sad. And that's the left. And that's to speak to what you were saying earlier about Donald Trump as a reaction to that. Remember the Huffington Post? They said, we're only covering Trump in the entertainment section, not the political section. Now, Mitt Romney would have rolled over. George W. Bush would have rolled over. Every other candidate we've had, even Ted Cruz, probably wouldn't have reacted to that. And Trump said, hey, Ariana, didn't your husband leave you for a man? Yeah, he did. I think he made the right choice.
Okay.
So You asked for a pit bull, and we got a pit bull.
Okay, gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on political correctness. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, Rob, let me go back to you. Does the left think this whole identity politics and virtue signaling, this Me Too movement, is it a winning strategy? Because in looking at the senators that we all got to know so well over the last 2 weeks, first of all, they seem to all read the exact same bullet points. You know, the talking points are identical all the way through. Is this a message that's getting through to the voter as we approach the midterms here? Is it a winning strategy in your mind? Go ahead.
No, and in fact, I should mention and plug myself. I have a new column with Newsmax, and I've written about this now over the last 3 weeks, and I think my last three or four columns have focused on the fact that there's no unified voice in the Democratic Party. There's no leadership. And what they do basically is whine about Donald Trump. And their reaction to me saying and writing that has been, then you're not a Democrat. Why? Because I disagree with you, because I don't toe the party line. If I'm really a true liberal and Democrat who cares about his country, then he wants to see his party do the right thing. And I don't see that now. We don't deal with any issues. And the big Democratic mistake, and I think the lack of a blue wave, is going to be that just because Donald Trump may be the worst president in history doesn't mean that the other party should win in the midterm elections based on that. What are you going to do? What's your plan? What are you going to do for the country? What are the policy points? And that's not there. And they have no actual candidates that I see. My God, it's an embarrassment, especially Cory Booker. He cries way too much. He cries more than Joe Biden.
I hope he's the nominee. Oh, that would be a lot of fun there. You know, Rob, I do have a suggestion for you. Maybe you should be more visible carrying your Mao's little red book, and they'll probably cut you a little bit of slack, okay, on the left. Okay, Daniel, the whole thing is this message.
I've always been a provocateur.
Okay. You know, we're told on the left that, you know, diversity is our strength. But it seems to me that is diversity at the expense of unity. And I think it's it's actually a small number of people that are ideologically possessed that are motivating this and intimidating people. Rob just gave an example right there. Get in line, repeat the party line here. That is the opposite of unity. And I don't see much value in diversity if it is just going to be ideological possession. Go ahead, Daniel.
We see this on campus all the time. People talk a lot about diversity being our strength. First of all, since my ancestors came from Austria-Hungary, I'm not convinced of that general point, but leave that aside. They're interested in diversity of skin color and so on, but definitely not of political views. A few people had signs just the other day on our campus supporting Brett Kavanaugh, saying, confirm him. And none of these were nasty. None of these were attacking Ford or saying anything other than support the nominee. They were attacked by a large crowd that was put together very, very quickly, that came and was shouting them down, ripping up signs and so on. There are courses I can no longer teach because those are courses in which I surveyed arguments on both sides of certain political questions. I don't think you can do that on campus anymore. And increasingly, you're under attack for doing that in the larger culture. Criticize an open immigration policy, and all of a sudden you get accused of racism. Say, wait a minute, due process is important, and we can't tell who's telling the truth here unless we wait for evidence. You're accused of being a sexist and a rape apologist.
Well,
so I see the bounds of acceptable discourse shrinking very
rapidly. Yes, of course, the Constitution was written by white slaveholders. Why should the Constitution have any kind of value, okay? I mean, you know, Gavin, you know, I used to teach at the University of California, and even then, this was 20 years ago plus, even then, it was teaching ideology and not scholarship. And it's one of the reasons why I left, okay, because it wasn't a place to think and have debate, because that's the only way you're going to get knowledge is debate. I don't see it happening anymore. And I see the left just come up with their talking points and then they don't want any discussion. That is a tragedy. And it only opens up the possibility, I think, of violence eventually. Go ahead, Gavin.
Should we just throw in the towel on academia?
I mean,
post-secondary education.
I do.
It's like travel agents. You don't need them anymore.
It's a waste.
We have the internet.
It's a con. It's a con job.
And they're coming out dumber than when they went in, but with more debt and less life skills. It's like the opposite of what it used to be. I don't know. I don't understand how you could be a professor anymore. We got Michael Rechtenwald, who was a communist. And he was deemed too far right wing. They just moved his office into the Russian section of NYU, and he's getting pushed out this year.
Okay, well, I'm sure somebody in the left can explain it. I want to say here, all due respect to Daniel, okay, I know you're a conservative and I know you're a good scholar here, but my very point here is, let me go into Rob, is that, you know, it is in many cases here, you have these middle class families, they drop off their kids at university and then they come back programmed. And actually, in many cases, not really skilled to work in the modern economy. And I guess, you know, you take activism 101 and you get a degree in it, okay? And you're fluent in it, okay? And I guess go to George Soros and you'll get a job. The economy needs well-skilled people here. And the university used to do that.
I would merely like a check from George Soros.
I don't want any of his money, okay? You know what I'm getting at, Rob? You know, and that's why I'm bringing up the university.
Yes. Here's a big problem with liberals as a whole is Republicans are ideologues in many cases, but they remain true to their particular policy beliefs. Democrats act on emotion, so a typical emotional response will be, do you care about the poor? Then you have to want to take care of the poor. Yes, I care about the poor. I step over them all over the place in the subway in New York City. But if I tried to take care of all of them, where would I get the money from? And too many of these questions and issues are addressed with pure emotion without any realistic response. Joe Biden, I saw him cry 2 years ago when I was at a conference because he wanted to send every person in the country to junior college. I mean, why aren't we talking about technology and robotics and what we could do if we train young people now who may have been a coal miner 40 years ago or a plumber, and now they want to learn how to fix robots, which are going to be running the world in another 20 years. So we don't deal with that. We just deal with tugging on our heartstrings. I'm going to cry because we don't have free education. And it's based on selfishness and self-aggrandizement from the Democratic Party right now. They got to get in step and figure out where the world's really going.
You know, Daniel, do you come across on campus people promoting the ideas of socialism? Is this the new mantra for young students at the university?
Absolutely. The number of people who are socialists is very high, significantly higher than it was 5 years ago.
Do you think they know what that means?
No, I think they have no idea what it means. In fact, when people have come onto campus and asked students, so what is socialism? They really can't give you any kind of answer. And in my courses, where I actually talk some about this and come up with definitions of socialism and a variety of other isms, you can tell that people haven't thought this through, that they're somewhat surprised to think about it and actually come up with a definition. Most of them, I think, consider themselves socialists because they think it's important to help other people. And that charitable impulse is noble, but it doesn't translate into a political program or an economic program. And so there's a huge gap in there that they haven't thought through.
Yeah,
can I interrupt for a second?
Yeah, because there's been a lot of politics based on virtue, okay, and it turned into totalitarianism. Go ahead, Gavin, go ahead.
Daniel, you need to quit your job. It's like a white guy in Harlem. Nobody wants you there.
Well, you got tenure. Daniel's got tenure, so you're pretty safe, okay? Daniel, go ahead.
Well, that's a part of There are places, I've got to defend the university a little, there are places where serious scholarship gets done, even within the liberal arts. Philosophy, linguistics, maybe a few other departments are still pretty serious and largely apolitical. And when you move into natural sciences, if you're doing computer science or physics or business or engineering, most of the faculty members are on the left, but it has relatively little to do with what they do in the classroom. Now, there are exceptions. I know somebody who teaches organic chemistry and spends most of the time ranting about Trump and not teaching anybody about organic chemistry. I think that's outrageous. But there are certain
STEM isn't even sacred anymore.
And they are powerful departments.
Okay, you know, Rob,
increasingly creeping in there, too.
I think that all studies programs should just be defunded across the country, okay? Every single one of them, okay? It's a waste of time. I think you heard about this scandal recently about these three scholars that wrote these fake articles, but they were picked up by gender studies and identity studies and all of that, you know? It's nonsense. It's just nonsense, okay? Because what it does is it doesn't teach anybody really anything. All it does is make you aware in one form or another, okay? I don't think it makes you a better person. I don't think it makes society any better. 1 minute left goes to the odd man out on the program, Rob.
Well, you know, this has been an ongoing problem for years. If you want to talk about gender studies programs and ridiculous things, I did an article years ago where I did research on government grants, and I came to find that not the worthy people don't get the government grants. It's the people know how to write the grants.
I know
so
all about that.
Our government pays for things like transferring, how you can translate something from Swahili into Sanskrit, and the government will give you $40,000. I don't know who can read that. And this is why we need reform. Is it ever going to happen? I don't know. As a result, I think instead you have people's anger that has bubbled over, and it's given us Donald Trump. Another liberal mistake is they think that just bad people voted for Trump. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. I think I learned that in science class. And that's why we have Trump. And if we don't open our eyes and see that, my fellow Democrats, then we're going to lose in the midterms, and he's going to be elected next presidential election.
Donald Trump has it made because the left lives inside his head. All right. That's all the time we have for, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in New York and in Austin. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.